Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight and to the Project Arts Centre in Dublin, and this our second public discussion as part of the 2013 Dublin Theatre Festival. Last week we looked at theatre and politics and the response of Irish playwrights and theatre makers to the various crises of our times. Today we look at theatre and place, the notion of home in theatre and to artists, and ask if a creative distance from home helps to make for good theatre. Several shows in this year's Dublin Theatre Festival explore notions of home, place, language, and the individual expression and exploration of belonging in this vast and sometimes tiny space called life. Desire Under the Elms, River Run, Waiting for Godot, The Hanging Gardens, and of course, Heartbeat of Home, the second wave, as it were, of river dance, has just opened, exploring old themes in new styles. Our panel today, Annie Ryan, Artistic Director and founder of Corn Exchange Theatre Company, which presents Eugene O'Neill's Desire Under the Elms at the current festival. Performer Camilla Sullivan, who will sing and act in the Royal Shakespeare Company's Rape of Lucretia, the little-known Shakespeare poem which she and her musical collaborator Fergal Murray have put to music. That opens at the O'Reilly Theatre in Belvedere on Thursday. Joining us again after last week's panel discussion, Helen Meaney, critic, reviewer of theatre for The Guardian newspaper and literature advisor for the Arts Council, and Eugene Downes, incoming director of the Kilkenny Arts Festival, former chief executive of Culture Ireland and also curator of the talks at this festival. Before we discuss anything else, could we try to define the concept of home for the artist and for people working in theatre? Camille, do you have a place that you consider home, and is that also the centre of your creative life or spirit?
I suppose physically, Dublin, I mean, I'm originally from Cork. Dublin is my home and it's my nest I always come back to, because I'm usually on the road, I tour abroad all the time. And when I'm abroad, I tend to kind of check in with myself that place that's home inside me is still there, because you kind of lose yourself as a performer when you're travelling away. So I think you have to kind of keep an essence of who you are. You're nomadic, you're gypsy-like, it's unstable, but this notion of, it doesn't have to be a room, it's just a place. And it's even maybe two or three things sometimes I bring with me from home. That just gives me a bit of stability, because, you know, everything else is, not that it's falling apart, but everything else is quite dramatic, and it's about giving yourself over to the audience. So home to me is a protective kind of shell where I can sit with my thoughts and kind of check in. Is what I'm doing as a performer, is that doing that right? And then when I do come home, which is so unusual and lovely, because what I miss when I'm abroad is people talking the same madness as I do, not making, you know, I'm going, oh, great. So that kind of thing of your friends and where you're from is essential to you when you travel abroad, and when you come back, just kind of sit with it.
So in a sense, you carry home with you wherever
you
go.
Yeah, I do. Irishness to me, I'm half French and I'm half Irish. But the more I travel, the more Irish I'm getting. I'm not sounding like a leprechaun out there, but I certainly know that, you know, you travel to places and with open arms, they welcome you as an Irish person. But I realise that the more internationally you tour, the more you kind of hold on to who am I, you know. And it's actually really fascinating to be in Dublin at the moment, seeing Irish shows go up, because you get even more of a sense that that's a shared thing right across the board, whether it's Waiting for God or Desire Under the Elms, you know, that there's a theme. I can't put my finger on it, but there is an Irishness to those plays. And sometimes I think what can happen is you can lose a sense of yourself when you're travelling. And so it's important to actually sit down and understand that.
Eugene Downes, from your experience of working in the arts over many years, do you think most artists have a strong sense of home, or is it, as Camilla's saying, in a sense, a movable feast? You know, it's home being where the art is, where you make your art, what you carry with you.
I think it's probably a trap to try and generalise, Vincent, that each artist has a sense of home in their own way, and some artists stay very close to home and perhaps write about home or make their work about home, and some do not. For example, Brian Friel, one of our greatest artists, has chosen to live his life very close to home and has rarely enough ventured forth from there. And his work has created this place, Ballybeg, Ballybeg, which in a way is an imaginative version of that Donegal town. But his physically being in that country, shall we say, and then creating versions of that countryside imaginatively through the centuries, through those different plays, is obviously something very intimate to Brian. Take an example, not from theatre, but perhaps an artist like Martin Hayes, who came from...
Great musician,
and who came from that particular traditional musical, almost terroir, of East Clare and Fecal. And for all of those years, what, 20 years or more that he was living in Seattle or Chicago or Connecticut, obviously that connection to Fecal and East Clare physically, but in the music, was critical. And then interesting that Martin's chosen to come back to live in East Clare again through time. And then other artists like, say, Pinter, where the idea of those rather threatening London interior scenes, again, the fact that he chose to continue living in London and his sense of being a Londoner was so strong, seems very personal, very intimate. So I think it's one of those things perhaps where a generalization would be fatal.
And I suppose sometimes as well, artists make a sense of home to create their art. If you take somebody like John McGarren, who's so closely associated with Leitrim, people forget that John actually chose to spend a lot of time as well, you know, in Dublin, in Paris, traveling, lived abroad. The primary identity is through the work in a specific place. Mm-hmm. Helen Meany, home for the artist. I suppose a real sense of home for the writer, at least, can be found in language.
Yes, and I suppose that often happens when an artist moves away from their native place, that they actually really immerse themselves in the language of their home place. I mean, I suppose an obvious example would be Joyce, who spent so many years reimagining and recreating Dublin, the streets of Dublin, the sounds of Dublin, and the place names and all those things in his work, having, you know, been in exile for such a long time. And as a the other thing is, I suppose, it can be the home place can become frozen in the past, so that the two notions of the past, your own personal past, and of the home place become sort of fused. And you can certainly see that in Joyce's work. And also in another writer whose work is being shown in this festival, Maeve Brennan, who, you know, moved to New York and spent really all of her writing life as a fiction writer recreating Ranelagh in Dublin, you know, and literally her parents' house and her childhood. So that she always drew from that well of memory. So those two things about possibly your formative years, not necessarily childhood, it could be teen years, and the home place mm-hmm. become sort of conflated and inextricably enmeshed.
Annie Ryan, is Dublin, is Corn Exchange, is the work you do here now your primary home?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been living in the same house for 20 years, which is, I can't believe I could be so old that I could live in the same place for 20 years. A little sweet crumbling muse house in one of the lanes in D4. But Dublin is absolutely my home now. And I was struck by what Camille was saying about that sense of community in that we're so lucky to have in our business, that creates a deep sense of foundation. But I suppose I'm an exile too. But I think, I don't know, being from the States, I'm from Chicago originally, and you know, when you're about five and you're in kindergarten, the two big questions are, what do you want to be when you grow up, of course, and then the second one is, what's your nationality? So if you're only the one thing, then you're 100% that thing. Yeah. So I grew up with this absurd idea of being 100% Irish, and you know, I've got that grandparents from Mayo and everything like that, and I'm actually very close to my Mayo cousins on that side, whereas the Ryan side were, you know, came over in the famine and stuff like that. But I'm absolutely like, you know, genetically from the bog. but if you're a couple generations removed, and then I think Ireland does, I think people, Irish people from here in particular, have a very strong sense of connection, possibly because we're a small island, Europe Minor, I believe Joyce called it. For me, I think Americans want to there's a sort of a lack of identity that is at the foundation of an American psyche. But maybe everybody's like this, like everyone is seeking belonging, you know, and so we attach ourselves to ideas of identity, of nationhood, of, we have a guy in our cast, Peter Coonan, really gorgeous, that guy, really funny, wild man, kind of, and he's so super Irish, you know, he's got the odd bit of Osgiliga and, you know, he's loving his pints and the guy and all that, and I think, wow, like, he's really, you know, to what degree are you attached to that Irish identity, you know? If you're like me, I came over, a friend of mine said, well, if you're not living in the place where you're from, then you're sort of on the surface of things. You don't really, I will never be from here. Mm. I can't really ever take real root. So I have to find a foundation in another way. And the thing that I find, it comes up in my work all the time because I don't have that foundation. So I'm constantly going, what am I doing in this mad country? Yeah. And, you know, the longer I live here, actually, the more American I think I am. Having said that, I've been here for so long that if I went there, I'm now really Irish. So I'm totally schizophrenic, probably, in a kind of culturally. I'm on the surface, you know. I feel like a wave could come and maybe take me off somewhere. But if I did, then I would be from Dublin. Just thinking about the work, I'm constantly thinking about that lack of belonging people have. I think that's really what interests me the most in what we all do, is that as people, we're looking for that foundation somehow. And whether you attach yourself to your nationhood and celebrate that, which is a great thing to do, or don't. And some people really come away from that and find their identity by doing the opposite or whatever. Mm. But to me, it's all illusory. It's none of it really, it's all identity that you're attaching to yourself. And really, really all you have is now and your own sense of foundation in yourself.
I want to talk to you about the production of Desire Under the Elms, Eugene O'Neill's great play, in a moment. Mm. But before that, I'm really interested in that idea of, you know, growing up, identifying as 100% Irish, American, and now feeling, having lived here, feeling more American. Eugene, I'm just thinking of the Imagine Ireland project in the States in 2011. Did you encounter much of that kind of sense of duality of Americans who felt such a strong sense of an Irish identity and came to see the work that you helped to bring there?
I think we found that, and it, not just during Imagine Ireland, but all of the time, I suppose, that we spent in Culture Ireland or personally working in the US or having artistic projects there, is that Irish Americans, again, very dangerous to generalize, but seem quite happy to have that sense of dual identity, that the two parts perhaps are in some cases maybe at war with each other, but by and large are very happy to identify as Irish and as American. I mean, it's interesting that people like Bill Clinton or Joe Biden, for example, very happily announced, as I think Bill Clinton did last week or the week before, I'm Irish. That's why I can do impressions, when I think Bono had impersonated him at the Clinton Global Initiative. So, in fact, even dropping the hyphen, dropping the American bit, but I suppose the unspoken thing is, of course, we're American. So we're happy to say we're Irish as well. Now, in terms of, for example, bringing a theatre production to New York, the Irish American community wouldn't necessarily be known as a core part of the theatre audience in New York. Other ethnicities, the Jewish community particularly, would be, I suppose, a core of the New York theatre group. So there was a certain interesting tension in perhaps drawing in an audience that wasn't core to that, but equally bringing Irish work to the mainstream New York audience. So that was important. But what we found with artists like O'Neill, or like John Ford, for example, where we presented some of his work at MoMA, was that Ford, who is, I suppose, rightly celebrated as one of the greatest film artists of all time, in America, his Irishness would not necessarily always be central to discussion on him, either artistically or biographically. And even back here, we don't, in the same breath as we would claim perhaps great writers as Irish, we wouldn't always have drawn Ford back in as this artist of world stature. So I think even in different art forms, we're perhaps more ready to try and lay claim.
Camille, travelling abroad, as you do, you're touring internationally, do you find the tag of Irish useful? For instance, in Australia, which has a huge Irish influence,
it
does coming in as an Irish performer help to open doors?
It's an unusual one. I do think people do love, when you say you're Irish, they just smile, they're delighted, and you're like, I'm Irish. The accent gets even stronger when I'm going abroad, just to let them know. But I think what is unusual is that they usually think that I'm singing Irish songs. I've never sung possibly an Irish song ever in my set. I think that was an interesting thing, when you were speaking, I was thinking, you know, because you have an idea of home doesn't mean you have to be, you know, that it's focusing just on being Irish. Even though I'm a lover of trad music and I'm a lover of Irish themes, I think what's interesting is when you go there, it's not necessarily Irish audiences that come to flock to you. And that's what a lot of people think. Oh, it must be the Irish and American thing that come. It's actually the Australians or the English. And it's up to you as a performer to go, where do I stand? And I don't want to make it sound like you sit there going globally, but where do I stand as an artist who is anywhere in the world? And how do I, and what is truthful to me is that I'm an Irish person. So I've been brought up with a psyche. I've looked abroad, watched TV, kind of been brought up on British TV, American TV. I think Irish people have a very good understanding what's happening outside their island. And not necessarily people have a view of the Irish, which is a bit more probably, you know, not the horse in court, but they have a different view looking into us. So I think we come armed with an understanding and a self-depreciating nature when we go abroad. And I think they welcome us with open arms. And I think it's important that you don't play the Irish card. I might do it on a thing of when I'm meeting people in person, but certainly as a performer, I don't go there. Because I think if you have to stand shoulder to shoulder with other performers, it's got to be something else. It's got to be actually that you're not using your identity as your cachet. Do you know what I mean?
You're coming in as an equal in artistic terms. And that must have been the case for you very much so in relation to the RSC.
Going
in to tell me a little bit about this production, about the Rape of Lucretia, and I suppose this big departure for you as a performer, you know, is both singing and acting in this production for the RSC.
Well, I suppose to give it as a bit of a background, and this will explain again, when I first started here in Dublin doing small gigs, I was doing old French, German, Nick Cave, Tom Waits. Everybody was like, what are you doing? Why don't you, you know, do songs from here? So that was a starting, and that led on to then doing Edinburgh, which was a small step physically to, you know, go by boat, but psychologically it was a massive one. I was terrified, and I still am every year doing it. But what it's done is a platform for many Irish artists, which is amazing. I didn't realise that portal would be a shop window that would open my life to playing all over the world. This one place was so critical. And I was so terrified, and it was the best decision ever, because out of it came Mrs. Henderson with Stephen Frears, and then Le Clique being an original performer of that, and then the RSC, because I'm always doing dreadfully in auditions. I fail miserably. I'm too terrified. But I'm grand when I'm on stage. I can do my thing. And that's what happened with them. It's the Elizabeth Freestone, lovely lady who directed me in this. She saw me up on stage. She thought, right, she sings dark tunes. She's a narrative storyteller. She's chameleon-like. She changes. She's interested in being provocative. She likes to switch from being man, woman, child, and all the rest. And I didn't see it myself. It took her to look at me in Virgo and go, do you know what? I think we should put this lesser-known poem, should take you, and you create the music to it. You become the different characters. I says, are you completely mad? I am terrified of Shakespeare. It's not my national tongue. What are you doing? She says, have a drink, you'll be grand. And that's essentially what happened. So that was someone seeing something in me that I couldn't see myself. And she said to me later, and even Ceci Berry, who is in the RC, who's an amazing woman, who's kind of, I pronounce this wrong, aficionado of how to speak Shakespeare. She said, we chose you, Camille, because you're Irish. You don't taught to be a Shakespeare actress. You have a way of telling stories and song. And that's where I'm happily sit. Now, the acting thing, I'm a bit more like, what is going on? But they helped me. What was amazing with that, as they said, stop getting so, don't get taken over by the poetry of it. It's an emotive 3D story. Tell the story. It's very plain. It's 400 years old. It could be told today. So those two things helped me to transfer. I brought 50% of what I do. That is essentially still what I do on stage, and the other 50%, like a performer, I had to learn how to do something new. And what was incredible with this was, you know, here we are thinking we've never done, you know, Shakespeare isn't our thing, we did in Leaving Cert, not sure of that language, actually quite scared of that language. And as an Irish person, how do you bring your thing to it? And we, you know, Fergal had been in Goldsmith College in he's from Derry, but he had, you know, trained there. And the two of us sat together and we just took the lyrics of that. We took what we know how to do and practical, you know, what we do every day is to take almost what a song to me is, like a poem or a monologue, and you make that 3 or 4 minutes live as a person. So that all, sitting with that poem, it was basically 3 hours long. We had to put it down to a 90-minute play, find the characters in it. And it's nice when you suddenly go, oh God, I have learned something over the years, is how to be able to express yourself that way. And musically, we didn't go, we went into, again, world, not Irish, not English, not past. What is the most truthful way to tell a story? Like, I always think hymns are a very good way to make the lyric come out. And it's the simplest thing. So, I mean, I'm a big lover of Nick Cave and stuff, and it's just really the most simple notes. So you couldn't really tell whether that's an Irish background or an English one. And that's why it works. And that's what we want to do. We don't want to make it kind of, you know, my accent is probably the only thing that gives it away. So it was a very exciting journey with them. We're very lucky because, you know, I didn't realize half the time I was being auditioned every time I came back, which was a good thing because I was like, what are those 20 people doing in this room? So they were, you know, I need to be kind of sometimes naive to get through this business. But, you know, I'm glad I am. But it really was. So we sometimes sat in Stratford by, you know, there's a romantic thing looking at the swans going, how did us get here? That's where Shakespeare was born. That's where he, you know, died. And we're doing this amazing poem. So it felt like an absolute honour. And
would you give us a very brief summary of the tale as told in by Shakespeare, and then maybe do a very short excerpt from us,
no,
just to give us a flavour of it?
So basically, it's called The Rape of Lucrece. Tragedy is always in Shakespeare's, it doesn't, you know, end well, as you can guess from the title. But it's always the beautiful way, the haunting, beautiful way he uses words and metaphor, nature and animals and everything that he used in that. But it's a story that Ovid and Livy told from 509 BC. Lucrece basically was the daughter of a wife of a noble man. And Tarquin was the son of the king, and he raped her. And in doing so, she became metamorphosized into the symbol for a political symbol for bringing down the royal family, and from there on in the Republic became. So it was through this terrible act. Now, in we took out of this three-hour poem, we took out the politics and we focused on the story of a man and a woman and what happens when this beautiful, good person and evil is unleashed and what happens. And that's always the wonderful moment in a Shakespeare play, is that transformation of personality. And I was saying the other day to someone, you don't need to go to see a psychiatrist these days, just read a Shakespeare play. You'll understand the psyche of a man and a woman in this play. It is phenomenal. And it is, you're swimming in his words. He has a great understanding of what a woman might have gone through. And I just, to me, I've never experienced that in his plays. Of course, I have, but not in the way I did with her being the vocal voice. And so basically, she is this beautiful, chaste woman, and this terrible thing happens to her. And the moment it happens, she changes forever. And it is her mind and her mental and physical fight with herself, which goes on for a good 20 minutes, which is, you know, if you think of a 400-year poem, I kind of thought any woman or any man would understand that. So in it, I play the narrator, who is really Shakespeare's mind. I play the offender, Tarquin, and I play her, and I play the father who comes later, because she takes a very sad decision on being raped. It's almost like to be or not to be, a female version, to kill myself. She has this question in her head: my dignity, my soul, my body, it's taken, what's left? So it's a very vulnerable and sad kind of moment and insight into her mind. I'll sing you maybe a little verse of what her dad sings to her on her death. And I think it's, you know, it's a all fathers, all mothers, you know, it's a thing that they can empathize with. So this is her father, Lucretius, who pines for his daughter. And just a little verse or two. Daughter, dear daughter, old Lucretius cries, that life was mine that thou hast here deprived. For in the child the father's image lies. Where shall I live now, Lucretius unlived? Thou was not to this end for me derived. If children predecease progenitors, we are their offspring, and they none of ours. O time, seest thou thy course and last no longer, if they surcease to be that should survive. Shall rotten death make conquest of the stronger, or leave the faltering feeble souls alive? The old bees die, the young possess their hive. Then live, sweet Lucretius, live again, and see thy father die, and not thy father thee. It's usually with piano, but you know, it's his lyrics. It's early in the morning, but.
And that production opening at the O'Reilly Theatre in Belvedere on Thursday. Helen Meaney, thinking about what Camille was saying there, that the kind of vulnerable strength of women in plays and theatre, and that very much at the heart of much of Eugene O'Neill's work, and we see it again in the production, in Corn Exchange's production of Desire Under the Elms, a play that really has very strong resonances for Ireland. I mean, I was astonished at how relevant that play seemed to so much here, you know, land and madness and men and women.
Yes, men and women. And just listening to Camille there, there's another link which is about the death of a child, you know. So there's I think what was striking seeing Annie's production the other evening for Corn Exchange was how much grieving there is in the play, and that O'Neill, when he was writing it, was mourning the death of his mother. And of course the Iban, the young son and the central character really, is grieving for his mother, and he pictures her spirit almost as living on the land and being there in the elm trees, and it's just so powerful and very poetic. And all you also feel, though, that there's no escape from that. If that's how you conceive of the world, it's sort of very pitiless, and there is a harshness in the play, and I think the way Annie has directed it, the cast are using Ulster, well, Northern Irish accents, and that really does bring it home, that it is about a struggle with the land, a struggle over ownership, and then a really primal battle between the men and the women. Even though it's also drawing on these very symbolic and mythological themes, especially from the Greeks. You know, you've got obviously a very strong Oedipal theme of the son trying to sleep with his mother I mean, she's a stepmother, but it's sort of in a metaphorical way, and also destroy the father. And then you've got the myth of Phaedra and Hippolytus as well, and even a hint of Medea. I mean, there's just so much going on. It's incredibly rich and quite strange play, I think, to us. But the Irishness is hugely apparent, yeah.
Strange, and I think very familiar, and I think that's the power of it. And again, home is referenced, Annie, several times in the play, and it's a very harsh home. And again, that's very interesting, how we shape what becomes home and how we choose to leave it. I mean, at the beginning of the play, we have the two sons who are leaving to go to California to seek their fortune. They're leaving home. They're going off to make a new home. What made you choose this particular play to do here at this time?
It's a play that I've known for a long time, and that it's been on the list for a long time. I nearly did it in 2001, and I think it was 2001, and we did Lolita instead in the Abbey at in the Peacock, and I think we couldn't get the rights or something. I can't remember why we didn't do Desire, but so it was kind of like I thought I was doing something else this year instead, and I went, oh well, let's do this. Right, so it's this kind of mixture of all of these Greek plays, and O'Neill is a young man writing it, and he's trying. He's been influenced by the Abbey Players, actually, and Sing in the 1920s, and Ibsen, and he's trying to write this intense experience, amazing theatrical experience that has sex and death and infanticide and, you know, the works, basically. And it was really shocking at the time. In fact, the cast in Chicago were arrested after the performance for being so indecent. But for a contemporary audience who, you know, we're so sophisticated in terms of narrative. And so we've been really struggling with the narrative, because what he does is he writes in these cycles, and he tells you, he tells you what's going to happen in three over and over and over and over, and we're going, we know, you just get on with it already, you know. So we are cutting it. We really are diverting away from the text. I had one idea early on, which is we should do the play at all. We should just read the stage directions, which are so mad and so full. I mean, every single line has a kind of threateningly or throwing herself on the ground, but, you know, it's totally over the top. So he's coming from really a melodramatic tradition, trying to make something really serious. And it is considered one of the first important American dramas, and absolutely lays the land for Miller, Williams, all the important playwrights. Absolutely, he's the grandfather. And I wonder if he really influenced James and Cain. It's very post Men Always Rings Twice. So there's all of these themes in it, and it's so Irish. I mean, I can't believe it hasn't been done here since 1976.
It is astonishing, actually. And it's great to see O'Neill done again.
Like, occasionally I listen to it and go, maybe there's good reason. Like, it's really, it's a really weird play. It is a hard play. Because we do, Well, on the first preview where Helen was, I was sitting there going, okay, it's very dramatic for the characters, but not for the audience, because we were like, we know they're going to have sex. So we're like, come on, have sex. Like, why? You don't need to have any of the scenes, actually. They could just stand there, look at each other, and just do it. You know, we know what's going to happen. So how do you try to make an experience happen in the audience and, and still really serve the play? And I was struck by what Camille was saying about the simplicity of, and actually the power of hymn, weirdly, because this is a very Protestant play, actually, very super prod play, very Calvinistic idea of God.
That's certainly a very strong presence in it, and which links to my other question, which is, did you make a conscious decision to bring that Irish dimension out in it? Because
I thought it would really connect with Irish audiences, because it's so, it feels like John B. Keen, it feels like there's, you know, it feels so Irish, it feels like a Tom Murphy,
MacGarren's The Power of Darkness. I was reminded
of
somebody.
It's a rural tragedy, you know, and so it has all that going for it. So I knew it would translate, but I didn't know. We played around a lot early on with whether we set it where it's supposed to be set, which is New England, but it's written in this bananas pirate dialect where they're always saying "I" and "we're a coming" and stuff like. So all the auditions were in kind of, you know, real, like, I don't know, Appalachian. But the truth is, no one talked like that in New England. And so I think any production of this play, the company have to grapple with the accent, because it's so bananas. It really is like, well, how we come to home. You know, here we be to home. Home spelled H-U-M. All the here's are hars. It's really odd. And when we started playing around with Ulster, it kind of landed the language in a place that was really identifiable. And I guess to my ear, like, I'd much rather have that than have people doing kind of general American-y accents that aren't really rooted in the real place, because we don't know what that should sound like anyway.
Mm. It's interesting. I love the idea of different spellings of home, and in a sense that links to Beckett and Joyce and to Finnegan's Wake in particular. And thinking about Alwyn Ferrier's terrific performance in River Run here at the project at the moment. And Eugene, that, you know, I saw it the other night. I found it deeply moving, powerful, insightful, and very entertaining. And I suppose it's a piece that really questions how we make home in any language. And it's a piece that, in a way, transcends place and language.
I'd agree with that. I think I've seen it twice so far. I was in again last night, and it is truly an extraordinary evening in the theatre. I wouldn't necessarily say an evening of theatre, because it's so much more than theatre, performance in that larger sense. And in terms of the book, I couldn't claim to have read Finnegan's Wake straight through or in any other fashion. But having experienced how Alwyn made it live for us in the darkened theatre, that sense of circle or cycle was so present that I suppose it's the nature of that work that the river flows and then in a way comes around, and the way she presents almost the physics of that, the sense that the energy flows, as she called it, dark energy, and that part of that is random and unpredictable, and so you won't necessarily come back to the same place. And maybe that's part of this issue of exile and return, or leaving, that it's like the old principle in Heraclitus, I think, that, you know, you can never step into the same river twice. And in the same way, the Anna Livia, the character of that river, is so various, is and how Alwyn, of course, the theatrical and performative physical elements that she brings to bear to make that so various and so present for us, again, is extraordinarily embodied and virtuosic. But she starts the piece with Sanskrit, with, I think, the Sanskrit word for that moment between night as it turns into early morning. And that helped, I suppose, to take us out of the semantics of language. So we weren't just situated in Dublin or in English or in Hiberno-English, but actually in a much more universal place.
We're immersed in sound, and it's extraordinary. That brings us on a journey. And that journey, Helen, again, you know, the presence, I suppose, of Beckett and Joyce in this year's festival through work like this and Waiting for Godot. So it reminds us of the creative power distance can bestow, and this choice to make a home somewhere else and to inhabit another language and culture. I suppose it's good to be reminded that a choice like that can be a very positive one.
Yes, and very deliberate in both their cases. And you have to think, well, why did they want to get away from Ireland? What was it, you know, that they felt that they could only do their work if they weren't here? And that's, I think that's a really positive sort of step that they both took. There was anger on Joyce's part, particularly about the Catholic Church, but it was also that sense of artistic freedom and distance. And in both Joyce and Beckett's cases, I mean, they were making such new and different work, and it was really groundbreaking. And don't forget as well how hostile the reception to it was at the time, you know, both Ulysses to Finnegan's Wake and to Beckett. I mean, I think we've seen a lot of Beckett in recent years, and he's almost become re-assimilated or sort of domesticated. I mean, and if you think about, you know, Vladimir and Estragon and Paul So Unlucky, they're almost cuddly now. I mean, they're kind of, you know, they're kind of clowns. It's the comic aspect that we've become very familiar with. But seeing it again last night, Godot, just thinking about the strangeness and newness how radical it was. But if Beckett needed to go to Paris and write in French to create that work, well, that's what he had to do, you know. And the payoff was extraordinary, and even if it meant a sense of deracination and exile and loneliness. And we know that in Joyce's case, it was very, very painful, you know, and you're away from your family, you're away from your roots, but it is a conscious choice, and that it's done for the sake of making great art. And that's, I think, incredibly admirable.
Annie, do you feel that there has been something positive for you as an artist in forging that distance between where you grew up and where you chose to live? Do you think you've made different work here? I mean, do you think it has been good for you as an artist to uproot yourself and move?
Well, I don't think I would be one if I didn't. I think I would be a very different one. But really, the opportunity that this country gave me was really to be a maker of work. I think if I had stayed in the US, I would probably still be performing. Now, I probably will perform again someday if I can figure out how to do it. But I would have continued acting, and I don't know if I would have become a director or a maker. Certainly, there isn't, you know, anything like the opportunities that I had here to pretty much do whatever I want. Like, I want to make a piece like this, and I've been incredibly fortunate to have come here at a time when all of that was growing. It's much more difficult now for the generation coming up now, or actually anyone under 40 it's like impossible almost. It's a miracle that they're able to make anything because there's really no money for them. But I was very, very lucky to come here at a time where in the early 90s, Dublin was just on the brink of exploding, and it was so exciting. Now, maybe that's what it's like for everyone in their early 20s, you know, the world is new and you feel this great sense of potential maybe anywhere, but I think that was a very special time here, and there wasn't, you know, there was a real outcry for physical work, for training, and I knew that I had that to bring, so I knew what I was doing coming here in a way. I really wanted to form a theater company and bring this tradition of really Chicago-based theater practice here, and people were completely open to it. And and the company afforded me an opportunity to really grow that work, and really, you know, it was really last year doing Dubliners and having 10 actors, and some of them were kind of my age, and a lot of them were a lot younger. And it was really sitting beside people like Derv Locrotti and Mark O'Halloran and go, "You're old now, like we really have been doing this for 20 years. You know, we have a practice. We have
you're mature.
We're mature, yeah. But also we know what we're doing on some level in the work, you know, so there's, and I don't think I would have had that if I had stayed in the States. There just isn't that kind of opportunity for artists. It's commercial.
It's interesting as well to think of that and to realize that it continues, you know, Annie coming in, but more recently we've had a new wave of immigrants into the country. Polish theatre, and there's been quite a vibrant Polish theatre community here.
Yeah.
And people like BZ Adigan as well, bringing something new. I mean, it's that we shouldn't forget when we talk about notions of home and home as reflected in theatre, because I think especially the Polish aspect here is very telling.
Yes, yeah. There's a company that was formed 3 years ago, Polish Theatre Ireland, and I saw one of their early productions, which was called The Taste of Chocolate, which was very much about a Polish diaspora experience, you know, mirroring, you know, for so many Irish families, where there was a family back in Poland under great pressure because their mother had left and gone to the US and she was sending back money. So, I mean, it was completely recognizable as sort of a scenario for us. And that company's done a lot more work since. And there is a growing audience, of course, among not just the Polish community here, but more widely. They've been staged in Focus and also here in Project Arts Center. And of course, you know, the traffic is two-way, you know, and I suppose it should be said as well that the internet has changed a lot of the sort of how absolute the experience of exile or emigration is, you know, was up till relatively recently, so that the people are much more networked and hooked up to the home place, you know, wherever that is, you know, either by Skype or reading the Irish Times online or Facebook and all these different things, so that there's an illusion sometimes of us being in one small place, one sort of networked space, but I think maybe that can also lead to a sense of loneliness too when you get offline and realize actually no, I'm in a very foreign place outside the window, you know. So, but it has become much more complicated. The experience of exile has become is not so simple and it's not so absolute, and that you can have a sense of belonging or of having multiple identities in the world now, that it's not either or, but it's a whole series of different identities that we can choose or we can take up and put down, just as Camille was saying, you know, sometimes she feels more Irish, but sometimes she doesn't want to play that very essentializing, you know, Irishness card. So it's we've become much more sophisticated and reflective about how we construct ourselves in this networked world.
That's the question I wanted to bring up briefly as well, and usually it's one you might look at. That idea of home now and exile. And is there a meaningful way in which an artist can be exiled today, you know, in this globalized world, you know, when we think of Skype, we think of technology, what is possible? Not for everybody, it should be pointed out, and let's not forget the many vulnerable people who are trying to flee as refugees, and we had that terrible drowning off the coast of Italy. Let's not forget people like that. But when in countries like Ireland, where we do have that globalised instinct and reality around us, that has changed things.
I think, Vincent, speaking in terms of artists, for example, quite a few younger Irish artists, be they, you know, actors or perhaps visual artists or other makers of some kind, may be among the many people who feel they have to leave the country for economic reasons. And whether they end up in the continent or in Australia or North America, and whether they come back in a few years or in a decade or maybe never, we do not know. But that's an important part of an experience probably for many younger artists in Ireland. There's also perhaps a reality of, and perhaps a very terrible reality, of a kind of internal exile for some artists who are exiled by their own community. And I think particularly of Gary Mitchell, obviously the playwright who wrote the most extraordinary plays on the loyalist community, and was you know, obviously treated in appalling his family in the most horrific way, and had to move physically, but also I suppose in a way almost spiritually and psychologically is sent to Coventry in that sense, but more broadly there's an exile for, as you say, the politically oppressed. I mean, the Belarus Free Theatre, which have been, of course, to Ireland, have been at times at risk of life and limb in making theatre either in Belarus or in being able to bring it out of Belarus. And also for some artists, perhaps the choice to return from exile when it becomes politically possible can actually be a very disillusioning one. Not just for the artists, but actually for their public, for the audience. Maybe we're lucky in one sense, it's unknowable, that neither Joyce nor Beckett chose to return. Mm. Because if they had returned, it could have been a terrible experience for everyone concerned, possibly. I mean, one thinks of a great artist like Alexander Solzhenitsyn, he, obviously one of the greatest writers and also one of the greatest dissidents of the Soviet period, who... I think in the mid-70s, was forced into exile, went to Vermont. And then 20 years later, when, after the fall of the Soviet Union, he was able to return to Russia, that was actually a profoundly disappointing reality, I think, both for him, who expected to find perhaps a different country, but also very much for not just his Russian audience, but for so many people internationally who had admired him both as an artist and as a human rights activist, and found that in that new Russia, Solzhenitsyn became an advocate for obscurantist policies, the wilder fringes of Russian nationalism, and actually one wonders if he had never returned, would that have been better? So there are certain upsides perhaps to an exile remaining in exile.
Beware of the returning artist. We have time for a few questions, if there are any, for our panel.
Okay, I'd love to have a few additional comments on Beckett. We link Beckett and Joyce together very often, but Beckett is the exception, it seems to me, of the man who went abroad and didn't nostalgically look back to Ireland. Quite the opposite. All this way we kind of obsess about Irishness, you know, are you Irish and do you feel Irish abroad? And he seems to have been free of that. Like, it's astounding, the celebrated reply to a British journalist who said, I think, are you British? And he said, au contraire. But very remarkably, it seems to me, and passing quickly over the fact that he wrote in French, in 1940, when Paris was occupied, he chose to do the thing that every expat did not do. He remained in France and he went into the resistance and he became part of that. Was that an adoption of France, or was that an adoption of the kind of universal human sense that he wanted, the outrage of Germany was too much for him. But he is a total exception. There are very few references in the work. I'm just thinking of Barry McGovern doing the monologue, Mr. Watt, which is set in a Fox Rock, I think, but there are very few references. Godot, I'm sure many of us saw Godot last night. It's totally universal language. There's no nationality of any kind about it. So all our obsessing about Irishness and so forth, he appears to be the outstanding exception.
Absolutely. I mean, in a sense, I think he made his home in the world and of the world, and has helped all of us to look to that as well in making our lives.
I think, yes, in Krapp's last tape, is there, I think, one reference to a place name in Dorky, is it, in the South County? Certainly, several people made the point when Michael Gambon played Krapp in the production at the Gate Theatre several years ago, that having the slightly submerged Irish accent of Gambon, someone who's lived most of his life in Britain, but actually the Hiberno-English undertone emerge and actually in a way inhabits the language of Krapp, which seems perhaps standard English or universal, but actually the Irish rhythms and idioms maybe bring the language alive in a way. And equally for Godot, if anything, I suppose some of the names are, I mean, Vladimir, Russian, and so deliberately perhaps distanced. But that countryside of the tree, the bear, is it, you know, for those of us, I suppose, who think immediately perhaps of some of that landscape in Wicklow or other parts of the countryside, and the degree to which he may have been influenced by Singh, and therefore is also extrapolating from the west of Ireland scenery, perhaps, so that in a way there's a strong Irish, whether a visual code or a linguistic code, embedded in the universalism, perhaps, of Beckett.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting when you go abroad, or even last night at the Godot, was you can see it's universal, but you can also feel the comedy of it, the Irishness that we can understand straight away. And it's, Mum being French always said, I'm so glad you're not fully French, Camille, because you wouldn't bring the other side of your madness to your, do you know what I mean? Like, I'd be too emotional then and everything would be quite serious. So I think what's interesting is you don't need to play on it, but just bring, you have an understanding to the psyche of where you come from 100 years back, and it comes through the work. And as you say, just through the subtlety of your how you speak in your Irish language brings something across. So I loved it last night too, like, I mean, revisiting it, going, yes, it's universal, but I can totally place it here. And he's not doing that. And I don't think if he'd been French, I don't know if he would have gotten, you know, some of those moments you just think are perfect, beautiful, incredible Irishisms on stage, you know, but they're, if you put them down on paper, you mightn't see it, but the way it was played.
I suppose Emily Bronte had to be an Irish woman. I was thrilled when I saw the programme for the festival to see O'Neill. He's not in Ireland, England. I can't see him anywhere. I'm delighted. I was delighted to see him on the programme. And actually, after the Kilkenny Arts Festival, I rang a few times the festival office to say, you know, I'm hoping that maybe next year you might do something by that great Kilkenny man. Because I think his father or his grandfather, I remember reading, left Kilkenny, just beside Kilkenny, just around the famine, towards the end of the famine, the late 40s. And Camille, your advocacy of Shakespeare as a condensed advocacy of the greatness of Shakespeare, it could hardly be bettered. You know, because I think myself, it's almost maybe going too far, but I think if you want to know human nature, you needn't look at people at all, study Shakespeare. But I'm really looking forward to both of those now, and thank you very much.
And Eugene, of course, will be director of Kilkenny Arts Festival, so more O'Neill in Kilkenny.
Not yet in a position to announce O'Neill in the 2014 programme, but you're right that the Kilkenny connection to O'Neill is actually very important. And actually several years ago in the festival, Fintan O'Toole gave a full talk and a full event on the Kilkenny connection of the O'Neill family. So it's been looked at, but how that can actually be put on stage. What struck me so much about something like Long Day's Journey, for example, even in Gary Hines' Druid production several years ago, was that for a writer who, to my knowledge now, Helen would be able to correct me, never visited Ireland.
Never, no.
No, yeah. And could have, but chose not to. And yet was suffused with the sense of what Ireland was in his mind and from his parents. That when in the play the father, Tyrone, is talking about the old country and the sense of the famine, and again, obviously the memory of that family having left it, the abandoned cottages, the people on the side of the road, that those ghostly images and the sense of Ireland being a ghost in his mind, both the people themselves, the place, that the fact that it was incorporeal made it even more intense and even more inescapable for O'Neill. So now how we represent that in the festival is...
And of course, perhaps that's why he chose not to come to Ireland, because to have come and seen the reality might have destroyed that imaginative vision of the country and what fed him creatively. And that's interesting too in terms of how we create an idea of home, and another one, a distant one. Thanks to our panel, Camille O'Sullivan, Helen Meaney, Eugene Danz and Annie Ryan, to all here at the Project Arts Centre, and special thanks to Dublin Theatre Festival, Willie White, director Leanne Bell and Eugene Danz, who curated these discussions. Don't forget, the festival runs until October the 13th. Do try to get to see as many shows as you can. Tom Norton was on sounds. Sarah Binchy produced this programme for Arts Tonight. Thanks to you, our audience, from all of us. Goodbye.
Arts Tonight was presented by Vincent Woods, and you can listen back to that edition on the RTE radio player, available online at rte.ie. The programme is repeated on Wednesday mornings at 4 on Through the Night, and you can also podcast it from our website, rte.ie/radio1/artstonight.